Well, welcome back to many of you. How many of you are joining us for the first time today? A few of you, a couple of you. So, can you hear me okay? Is this picking me up well enough? Let me know if I'm not talking loudly enough. Throughout the week, we've been talking about contemplative forms of biblical reading, and specifically, what does it mean to relate to this central story of Christianity, the story of Jesus's unjust crucifixion, in a way that isn't just about deriving a kind of theory from it, a kind of doctrine from it. In theology, we often talk about things like atonement theory, or we try to figure out why did this have to happen. And one of the things that I think these more contemplative approaches to the Bible encourage us to do is to leave those more abstract questions to the side and just confront the immediate reality for what it is. So last time we talked specifically about Martin Luther and ways in which he really revolutionized biblical interpretation, especially by insisting on the singleness of biblical meaning. In other words, really for 1500 years prior to Luther, it had been assumed that because God was the author of the Bible, its range of meanings was virtually limitless. It was basically any meaning that built up love in the Christian community was a meaning that God intended. And Luther, partly because of his quest for certainty, partly because of this new humanistic emphasis on the original languages of the Bible and studying the Bible in its historical context, really insisted on the singleness of biblical meaning, and he liked to talk about the clarity of Scripture, the claritas scripturae, that its meaning is just obvious, right, to anyone who's reading it honestly. And he begins to get very disappointed when that turns out not to be the case. We talked a little bit last time about Luther's favorite book of the Bible, the Letter to the Galatians, which interestingly has an allegory. It actually uses the word allegory at a really important moment and gives an allegorical reading of the story of Hagar and Sarah. And Paul interprets that really disturbing and terrorizing verse, "Drive out the slave woman from among you." Paul meditates on it until it becomes, "Drive out anyone who puts an obstacle to God's community, who puts barriers on God's community, specifically people who are saying, in order to become a Christian, you have to become Jewish first, and you have to follow the 613 laws of Judaism, you have to be circumcised." Paul says, "Drive all that out. That is slavery." And God's gift of grace is a gift of freedom that gives us the freedom to love and to figure out what love means in a particular time and place for ourselves. Today we're really going to transition to focusing very specifically on the story of the cross and ways in which that is echoed and reflected and unfortunately repeated in our world today. So I have to kind of warn you that today is probably going to be the most emotionally difficult of the class sessions, both in terms of the music we're going to hear from Considering Matthew Shepherd, which we've been listening to all week, this beautiful meditation on the hate crime in which Matthew Shepherd was killed. We're going to hear some really searing pieces of music about that today. We're also, put on the recommended reading list, this book by James Cone, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. I think Cone in this book does something pretty similar to what Craig Hallett Johnson does in Considering Matthew Shepherd, in the sense that he encourages us to see the history of American lynching through the prism of the cross and is kind of repeating or re-presenting this story of the cross. And we're going to look at some images from African-American artists of the Harlem Renaissance today that Cone talks a lot about in this book. And he's going to, one of the interesting things Cone says is decades, 30, 40, 50 years before a single preacher or theologian was making this connection between Christ and lynching victims in America, these black artists were presenting it so clearly. And what does it say about the church that most of these artists were not, like, you know, good church-going Christians, right? They're kind of on the peripheries of the church or not in the church at all. Mm-hmm. So how might that shape where we turn for theological truth and how we value art in the Christian community. So I'm just going to start here by playing a piece from Considering Matthew Shepard. It is basically, it'll begin with one of those prose sections telling the story of his actual killing. And then the musical piece will be about, primarily about his funeral, where members of the Westboro Baptist Church came to protest. So as you're listening, again, I'd encourage you to listen to it in sort of a contemplative way. Be open to what strikes you. Be open to just sort of what grabs your attention. And then think about ways in which the composer here is encouraging us to see parallels between the killing of Matthew Shepard and the response to the killing of Matthew Shepard and the much more familiar story of the cross. So this will be about a little under 4 minutes.
Carl, do you have a handout?
Oh, I do. Yes, thank you for the reminder. This will be the first one. So this is the one now. And I'll give you the one that we'll listen to at the end of the class now, just so I don't forget. But this will be for at the end of the hour. And there'll be another handout that we'll look at in a little while with a couple of quotations from James Cone's The Cross and the Lynch. All right, so if you don't get the handout right away, the first part will be one of those prose sections, so I think we'll probably be okay without it.
Gender Association. He then joined others for coffee at the college room. Around 10:30, he went to the Fireside Bar, where he later met Aaron McCain and Russell Henderson. Near midnight, they drove him to a remote area, tied him to a split rail fence, beat him horribly, and left him to die in the cold of night.
We listened to that earlier in the week.
Yes.
So we did. I'm a couple of tracks off here. I apologize for that. If you were here earlier in the week, you heard that section already. Let me just, I think I was two tracks off. I apologize.
Are there any extras of this?
But it's the one that we have a handout for.
So what we're looking at here is recitation 3, where it says, the next morning Matthew was found by a cyclist. That's the spoken part that's going to begin. And then the musical part will be track 9, A Protester. Okay, are we on the same page?
Yep.
No.
Yes.
Is there
another copy?
Yeah.
It's this one.
I don't have any. Maybe you could look on with a neighbor.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry for my confusion there.
The next morning, Matthew was found by a cyclist, a fellow student who at first thought he was a scarecrow. After several days in a coma and on life support, Matthew Shepard died on Monday, October 12th at 12:53 a.m. At the funeral, which took place on Friday, October 16th at St. Mark's Episcopal Church in Casper, Fred Phelps and the Westboro Baptist Church protested outside.
Amen.
I wondered if the use of the word German in the German word for crucify was a reminder of like St. Matthew's Passion or St. John's Passion.
Yeah, and I've heard the composer say specifically that he was basically citing that. So what is that, how does that expand our experience of this event to be quoting from the St. Matthew or St. John's Passion?
Really, it was connecting it with Jesus' crucifixion, which is amazing.
Well, it was Bach's musical interpretation of St. John or St. Matthew, and this is Craig Howell Johnson's interpretation and likening too.
Right, and there are tracks in here that have the word passion in their title, and he, the composer, I've heard him give several interviews, and he said he considered the calling this the Passion of Matthew Shepard. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely making that connection, yes?
I thought it also related to Hitler killing homosexuals.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I mean, the German there is, I think it points us to Bach, it also points us to National Socialism, and frankly, let's be honest, it's a big part of Lutheranism in that phenomenon, right? Both in Martin Luther himself, I think it's just the reality that Bach absorbed a great deal of that anti-Semitism as well. A couple of years ago, I was at one of the Bach museums in Eastern Germany, and they had a special exhibit related to the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, and the lead curator there said, people kept telling him he had to do an exhibit on Bach's anti-Semitism, and he kept saying, well, he held those views, but it was just sort of a reflection of the time. And then he started researching it, and he realized, you know, he really had unusually anti-Semitic views, and it's probably because he was a very devout Lutheran, and those themes are really deep in Lutheran theology. Other things that struck you?
Well, when they say crucify, crucify, mm-hmm.
yeah.
Slay Jesus.
Right, so I bet some of us have been part of those like readings of the gospel, like sometimes on Palm Sunday in Lutheran churches where the congregation is asked to yell, crucify, crucify. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In addition to that Bach quote with the German, there was right before number 9, there was like this little motive that's straight, I think, from Britain, from the ceremony of carols. And it was like the harp part right at the beginning. And the poetry in that is all about how the baby Jesus comes to like assail
souls of the souls of Satan.
Right, or to assail the souls of Satan and the foe and the foes of Satan and stuff. So, and it was right before the Westboro chorus, which it's interesting that he quoted two classical composers and two works that are performed an awful lot, but to support, not support, but to illustrate the views of the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah, yeah. And I think maybe one thing he's doing there is it's easy to sort of separate ourselves 100% from the Westboro Baptist Church, right? Like, that doesn't represent me, right? But at the same time, they're saying they're Christians. Somehow they're part of our community, right? And if we're going to claim to be Christians, then we have some responsibility for speaking against that sort of Christianity, right? Or recognizing our complicity in that sort of Christianity. Other things?
Well, in the narration, I thought it was interesting to talk about the evergreen and that theme coming through, and our use of evergreens to celebrate the beauty of Christ's birth, and also the evergreen is there at taking somebody's life, you know, and the tree, you know, the tree of Christ, and this tree again, but that connection with those who Christ has suffered for all and continues to suffer as well.
Right, and you know, I my musical knowledge is limited, as you can probably tell, so I wasn't thinking about that Britain piece, but especially if we are connecting it to the story of Jesus' nativity, right? I mean, think how many Christmas scenes you've seen with the pretty little evergreen with the snow falling on it as part of it.
Is that a metaphor that he uses throughout the piece?
Because I think there literally was a big evergreen by the fence. I also really notice in that same section that you were just referencing, the very sweet-sounding sort of lullaby section. I mean, there's a certain way of, a certain view of Christianity would see that as so wholesome. It's a parent putting their children to bed. This is the way the family is supposed to look. And yet, what evil can be covered by that appearance of wholesomeness, right? Yeah, and I think it's a question, it's not just for the Westboro Baptist Church, it's really for all of us. Anything else about how it, did it give you any sort of new ways of thinking about the crucifixion of Jesus? I mean, we've been talking about maybe how it helps us appreciate what happened to Matthew Shepard, but does it change the way you think about Jesus' death, Jesus' life in any way? Yeah.
This is my first exposure to this, so I'm thinking, you know, Jesus was crucified. Jesus wasn't the only one crucified. Matthew Shepard wasn't the only one crucified.
Right.
The Jews in Germany weren't the only ones crucified. And that how often do, you know, we good quietist Christians yell crucify rather than, wait a minute, this is wrong.
Mm-hmm. But he was tied to a tree at one time, and all I can think about is this 150-year-old post that had been soaking up all this
energy all these years. And at that point, that energy from that post was going into him and creating an essence that soothed the suffering that he physically was enduring.
Interesting.
He was being fed by that tree to take on another dimension.
That's beautiful. Was there another hand?
Yeah. Yeah, just the misunderstanding of Jesus as Messiah. I mean, what, he didn't fit the model, you know, just as the imagery there towards the end about boy with a boy, you know, that doesn't fit the model. Jesus didn't fit the model of what a Savior, a Redeemer, a Messiah would be. So we'll just get rid of him.
Yeah.
Good. Not only fitting the model, but also upsetting the norm.
Mm-hmm.
The two lines, where I come from, that's not the light. He asked for it, you've got that right. I mean, that could have been taken out of the Bible.
Exactly, yeah. I don't know how many of you were here, I guess Saturday night. It was my first night here, but there was a poem read at the service Saturday night. It was a pastor, a Lutheran pastor who wrote it, who's in Texas, who I've met, who's based in Austin, so it kind of grabbed my attention. But it was basically saying, you know, what would we do if Jesus appeared in our midst today? I mean, we'd call him crazy, we'd call him a lunatic. I think we'd like to think that we'd immediately welcome him, right? But I'm not so sure that's the case. Yeah. Yeah.
So on Tuesday, you mentioned, you were talking about fundamentalism as a modern expression, and you gave me a date of 1899 as the first time it appears in the literature. Mm-hmm. And I was taught that the concept of homosexuality appears in the literature for the first time in 1895, and I'm captured by that closeness.
Oh, wow. That is interesting.
And I see that both wrapped into these signs that the... Mm-hmm. that our Westboro brothers and sisters in Christ held at this funeral service.
Yeah, that's a really insightful comment. Yeah, and I can just support what you're saying, that the sort of the modern notions of homosexuality that we've shared, that sort of there's a fixed sexual orientation in people, that people are either attracted to men or to women. Just the very notion of sexual orientation in general is a really recent concept. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's problematic to look back at texts written 2,000 years ago, 2,600 years ago, and use them to speak to modern conceptions of homosexuality, because their entire conception of sexuality is different. And that's a subject for another day. But it's interesting to think about how the emergence of those two phenomena could be related. That's a really good point. Good. Well, you guys have given us a lot to think about, and I think that you have such insight into this piece of music. One of the things it makes me think about is when we talk about those ancient and medieval interpreters, the way biblical meaning is constantly expanding, constantly multiplying, that's the point, right? I think that when we talk about seeing Jesus, then sort of seeing that refracted through Bach, seeing that in Matthew Shepard, we're going to talk about seeing Jesus in Victims of American Lynching in a few minutes. There's sort of a similarity in those two processes, right? And I'm not saying they're identical. I think that, as we'll talk about next time, ancient allegorical interpretation is often a sort of movement towards a more abstract meaning in a biblical story, like this specific character symbolizes this idea. And what we're seeing here is, it's not about Jesus symbolizing an idea, it's Jesus being represented in a new person. Whether that person is gay people in Nazi Germany, gay people in Wyoming, whether it's Jews, whether it's American lynching victims, this encounter with the concreteness of the cross kind of demands that we look at the victims and people who are suffering in our world today, right? And it's interesting to think about this term contemplation, which we've been talking about. Remember, in Greek, theoria is a visual word. It's about what you see. But at least in sort of the conventional forms, the things you contemplate are the beautiful things, right? You contemplate goodness. You contemplate beauty. You contemplate, in Plato's philosophy, you contemplate the eternal forms, right? But what does it mean to contemplate the cross, right? What does it mean to contemplate or consider Matthew Shepard? What does it mean to open our eyes to what, when we talk about these lynching victims in a second, to what white Christians have done to African-American Christians? Usually were Christians. It was usually Christians doing this to other Christians. That's a really different sense of the word contemplation, right? So a lot of this art that we're talking about today, both in considering Matthew Shepard and in the artists of the Harlem Renaissance that Cohn points us towards, is encouraging us to contemplate suffering, to contemplate injustice, right? And frankly, this is a really deeply Lutheran idea. If you have been with me throughout the week, we looked at that really brief quotation from the Heidelberg Disputation, where Luther compares God being revealed in the suffering of Jesus on the cross to Moses seeing God's back rather than God's face. And that's all wrapped up in this classic mystical image of Moses seeing God's revelation not in light, but in darkness, right? In the cloud. And it is such a deep Lutheran idea to say, if you want to know what God is like, don't start by thinking about power and goodness and beauty and justice and all of these abstract eternal forms. Start by looking at suffering. Start by looking at the cross. Start by looking at Matthew Shepard, right? Because that's where God is, right? That's where you're going to see God. And that is such a deeply Lutheran idea. So let's transition now to this book by James Cohn. This was published first in 2012. I think I mentioned on the first day of class, I think this is one of the best books in theology written in several decades, and I'm not alone in this. It just received a major award in theology like a year ago, and has certainly been widely read. Has anyone here read it before? So Joe has. He's been to seminary. It's a really powerful book, and I would say you don't need to have a seminary education to appreciate it. It's certainly very sophisticated, very intelligent, but it's also very accessible. So I would recommend it to anyone, really. How many of us in this room are Lutheran? A lot of us, right? I think it's especially important for Lutherans because, just as a statistical fact, Lutheranism in America is the whitest major religious group in the United States. And that's not a joke. And actually, the ELCA is the number one whitest religious group in the United States. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is number two. Right. So there's a study you can find online by the Pew Research Center. If you just Google like diversity of American religious groups, Pew Research, it'll come right up. And so there's one group that is less racially diverse than the ELCA, and that's the National Baptist Convention, which is like 99.5% African American. It was formed when, it's a little bit of a complicated history, but it was a breakaway from the Southern Baptist Church when they formally endorsed segregation in opposition to the Civil Rights Movement. Okay, but the AME Church, the CME Church, they are more racially diverse than the ELCA or the Missouri Synod. Right, so this is, I think, something that we as Lutherans need to grapple with. I'm not saying it's purely a matter of sort of conscious racism. I think there's geographical factors. I think there's historical factors. But if it is this deep part of our tradition that God is revealed in darkness, right, in suffering, maybe we ought to start literalizing that a little bit as dark skin, especially when dark skin has been a marker of so much victimization throughout our history, right? So our history as a country. So Cohn's book is valuable for a lot of reasons, but I would say it's especially valuable for Lutherans. And frankly, Cohn never once references Luther in this book. I honestly don't know how the degree to which he was influenced by Luther at all in his writings. Did I mention he died just a month ago? I know I did on Monday. So that's sort of a tragic thing. But I would say I'm not aware of a better sort of embodiment of what Luther meant by the theology of the cross than Cohn's Cross and Lynching Tree. If you want to know what that whole business that's very famous in Lutheran circles in the Heidelberg Disputation is about, you could read those like five paragraphs in the Heidelberg Disputation, but then go and read James Cohn's Cross and Lynching Tree, because I think it embodies that so much. All right, so I did just want to start by reviewing a history that I think most of us have some knowledge of, but this is very central to what Cohn is talking about in this book. I'll also say that, you know, when I teach this book or teach this history with my undergraduate students, they certainly, I mean, they're aware of America's history of slavery, they're aware of the struggles of the civil rights movement. Almost none of them have heard of the history of lynching in America prior to coming to college. And I think it is a major part of American history, and it's one that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, but our culture as a whole tends not to want to talk about. It has become more prominent in the past several years. Has anyone ever read anything or seen speak Bryan Stevenson?
Right.
He wrote a famous book called Just Mercy, which is really good. I would recommend that. And he's founded an organization called the Equal Justice Initiative, and that there's a new museum of the history of lynching that has opened, I believe, in Birmingham, Alabama, within the last year or two. I haven't been there, but I would like to go there someday. In any event, when did lynching occur in American history?
1880s, 90s.
Yep, and then continuing
through the Jim Crow,
about to 1940. Through the 50s and 60s.
Right. Usually historians kind of take the murder of Emmett Till in, is it 1955 or 1956? As sort of the end. I'm not saying there weren't others since then, and certainly things like, you know, we all remember Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. Strike me as that different in some ways, right, from this pattern of lynching that we all inherit. But one thing I want to emphasize is that this is a post-Civil War phenomenon. This is something that happened in the late 19th century and really for the entire first half of the 20th century. And it was a form of white mob justice, or I put justice in big quotation marks there, where crowds of white people, and I want to emphasize, they would describe themselves as Christians, right? They would say, not only are they Christians, but they're doing this in the name of Christianity. They would publicly execute an African-American, usually a man, but sometimes a woman. If you had asked them, what would they likely have said that person was guilty of?
Rape.
Yeah. That was usually the accusation, and it was sort of the permission slip to perpetrate whatever injustice was about to happen to the victim. Certainly, as someone who, especially in this Me Too era, tries to listen to the experiences and perspectives of women, I would never want to disparage anyone's report of sexual assault. That being said, we have legal processes in place for a reason, right? And this is the opposite of going through a legal process. This is a form of pure sort of mob action that happens totally outside of any governmental or legal process. And usually it was an accusation of rape was made and the person accused of it was dead like within a couple of days. Lynchings were advertised in newspapers often. While it's true that, like, by the time of Emmett Till was killed in the middle of the night, there were no witnesses besides the perpetrators, the vast majority of lynchings happened to huge crowds of white people, right? So it was very much a public spectacle. It was meant to be seen. Most of the images that we have of lynchings were taken by not, like, responsible journalists trying to document what's happening for posterity, but spectators who are trying to show the spectacle that they enjoy. And often, I don't know the technology that well, but essentially like Polaroid cameras would be brought out and people would take photographs on the spot and then can print them right there into postcards so that those postcards could be sent to friends and family. Okay, so I do have some images of lynchings here that I think are worth looking at. Yeah.
Also, I'm thinking of the white civil rights workers in the 60s mm-hmm. would probably, I think, fall into this too.
There were several murders of, there's a pair of Jewish men from New York City who came down, I'm blanking on their names now, but there's a very famous killing of them.
Goodman and
Cheney
and Goodman.
Uh-huh, good. Yeah, you remember better than I do.
We were alive.
Good, but it's a good reminder that this sort of mass violence didn't just happen to African Americans, it did happen to white people, and the purpose was the same, mm-hmm. right? It's a warning. It's you stepped out of your place, and it's a warning to everybody like you, this will be what will happen to you too. Yeah.
It was similar to the reason that the statues were put up. It was an emblem of white supremacy.
Good.
And those same statues that have now been, some of them taken down, were not put up right after the Civil War. They were put up during this same era.
Exactly.
Yeah.
During the Jim Crow.
Exactly. And I think one way to describe, and this is a way that Cohn describes lynching in this book, is these black bodies hanged from trees and often being tortured and mutilated as they're hanging there, mm-hmm. These are spectacles of white supremacy, right? They are... ways in which white supremacy reinforces itself and perpetuates itself. That's the purpose of this event. One last thing before I show a couple of pictures quickly is I just wanted to mention probably the most famous lynching in history is that of Emmett Till. Did you all follow in the newspapers maybe 3 years ago? You know that the woman who he supposedly whistled at or said bye baby to, she's still alive, right? She lives in North Carolina. I share this with my students often because it helps them realize that this is not like studying ancient Athens or something like this. The woman that he was accused of violating is still alive, and her accusation against him that she told people at the time was that he had grabbed her. She never even claimed that he had sexually raped her, but that he had touched her. She has since recanted that to a journalist in the last 5 years, right? She said she made that up. He may have said, bye, baby, he may have whistled, we don't really know. But that really, I think that's the pattern with 99.9% of these cases, right? So I'm gonna show just a couple of pictures here. They are, they're small, they're gruesome. You can look away if you don't wanna look. I just think it's worth acknowledging the reality of what we're talking about here. So if you'd rather not look, that's okay. This is what we're talking about when we talk about lynchings. I think it's certainly important to pay attention to just how badly brutalized these bodies are. It's also worth paying attention to how many white people there are in these pictures, right? And they're there to be appreciative. They're there to sort of validate what's going on. There are many records of people bringing their children to these lynchings as a way to just sort of indoctrinate them.
I mean, they had picnics. I mean, that was a social event.
Yeah, it was sort of a festival. Yeah. Yeah.
So in no case, I find it interesting that in no case in these images are they KKK people with hoods on.
Yeah. No.
I mean, these are fully recognizable people.
Absolutely. So sometimes, perhaps in some cases, the people actually doing the physical killing would have identified as Klansmen or citizens counselors or whatever. Not even all of those people, but certainly most of the spectators were mainstream white Christians. So when King says in a letter from a Birmingham jail that he's come to the conclusion that the greatest threat to justice in America is not the Klansmen or the white citizens counselor, but so-called moderate white Christians, I mean, this is part of who he's talking about. The other thing, and I'll take these away in just a second.
Man, they look so proud.
Yeah. Right.
He looks so proud of it that he did that.
Right. So, and every one of these white people, or 99.9% of these white people, would say that they're Christians, right? And there are stories of white Christian worship services being interrupted so that they could go out to the sort of the town square, watch the lynching that's happening, and then come back and finish their service.
Yes.
Howard Thurman writes about that in Jesus and the Disinherited from the 40s. Yeah.
Can I just sort of throw this out?
Yeah.
A lot of times when something is really hard to get your head around or to look at or to think about, a lot of times we say, oh, I can't imagine. Like, I can't imagine what it would be like to lose your husband. I can't imagine what it'd be like to lose a child. I can't imagine that. I think the important thing is it's important that we actually do imagine. After the Sandy Hook killings, I heard a mother say, when everybody was saying, I can't imagine, and she was saying, it's important that we all do imagine what this would be like to be the victim, to be experiencing, to be the family of the people that have been lynched, because if we can't imagine what it would be like, we will continue to turn away, and we have to stop and imagine.
Yeah, thank you for that. Last thing I just want to point out here, I specifically chose a couple of images from non-Southern states, Nebraska and Minnesota, just to illustrate that this is not a purely Southern phenomenon. When I show images to TLU students, I choose primarily images from Texas, but lynching happened in every single state in the country.
Even Wisconsin?
I mean, obviously it was centered in the South. Mississippi was the number one state. Texas was the number two. But it happened in every state in the country.
Is there any kind of a guess about the number of people that were lynched over the 100-year period?
Around 5,000. So if you think about the 9/11 attacks, for example, that was about 3,000 people killed. We're very comfortable talking about that as Muslim terrorism, right? But what we're really talking about here is white Christian terrorism. And if you look at the history of, say, the last 100 years, I think it's just an empirical reality that more people have been killed by white Christian terrorists than by Muslim terrorists in the United States. I don't see how you could dispute that. So the central question of Cohn's book is, the central question is, what are parallels between the crucifixion of Jesus and the lynching of African Americans in late 19th and 20th century America? I think we've kind of talked about this a good deal already, but what sorts of parallels do you see here?
Well, they didn't have Jesus and those people didn't have a chance to defend themselves. You know, they just were set on crucifying them or hanging them.
So a powerless, innocent victim. Good.
Mob think.
Mob violence. And in the case of Jesus, I do want to be very clear, because some of the gospel stories, and certainly a lot of Lutheran tradition, leads us to think that it's Jews who are killing Jesus. Just as a matter of history, Jews did not have power in the Roman Empire to kill Jesus. The Romans only. They reserved that killing, or that power, for themselves. And they killed exactly two sorts of people, one being slaves who were rebellious. That's not the case with Jesus. He was never a slave. The second class is people who they saw as challenging Roman power, so suspected insurrectionists. And whether they were right or wrong about Jesus being that, that's the way they saw him. So I think it's important to recognize Romans didn't just crucify any old criminal. Like, they didn't crucify like shoplifters or someone who like murdered someone in a crime of passion, or just to rob them or something like that. They had other punishments for them, but crucifixion was supposed to be a spectacle of Roman power, right? It is a way of warning other people who might be thinking about challenging Roman power, you'll be next. And crosses were commonplace outside of all major Roman cities. And you, as you were entering the city, you would pass by the crosses, and that's a pretty powerful warning. Don't step out of your place. And I think lynching is doing something similar. Yeah?
I'm not suggesting that the Jews were responsible, but didn't the Jews go to Pilate and, you know, they were the ones that went and say, hey, we can't kill him,
yes,
but we want you to.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly something that the gospel narratives emphasize, and to the extent that is part of our stories, I think what's helpful there is to remember this is people from within Jesus' own religious community. It's not like Jews killing Christians. I mean, Jesus would not have known what a Christian was, right? I mean, let's be honest. This is people from, it's violence within a religious community or suspicion within a religious community. And in the same way, white lynching of African Americans is an inter-Christian event, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing with the civil rights movement, right? All of the major players in the civil rights movement are Christians, and yet they're on opposite sides, right? So this is why I think sort of taking responsibility for our tradition is so important. Right, because we can't let people who promote violence and injustice and racism speak for our tradition. Just because we're kind of running up against time here, I want to just show you some of the works of art that James Cone talks about. And what is powerful about these works of art is that they're all presenting lynching victims in Christomorphic sorts of ways. I don't know if you can read the biblical text on the tree there.
As much as you did it unto the least of these, my brethren,
you did it unto me. So that's from Matthew 25. Right? So that's from W.B. Du Bois. Mm-hmm. E. Sims Campbell. I mean, it's not exactly subtle what we're seeing here. And yet, I have a quotation from King that's going to stress this very explicitly. This is not a connection that was being made within church walls, right? I think it almost seems, like once we talk about it, it seems pretty obvious now, but it was not something that was being talked about then. The artists and the poets were way, way ahead of the people within the church walls.
The artists and the poets. That's true.
And this piece by Conte Cullen, The Black Christ, is accompanied by a poem. I'm afraid we just don't have time to read it, but you can find this very easily online. All right, I'll leave that up there. And let's just look at a couple of passages from Cone's The Cross and the Lynching Tree, and then we'll listen to one more short song from Considering Matthew Shepard. All right, so the first passage, how about I let you read the first passage on your own? I think this is from the preface to the book. It really summarizes Cone's overall message in this book in a really clear way. But just in the interest of time, how about we read the second passage together? Would anybody be willing to volunteer to read the second passage? Please.
Most black artists of the Harlem Renaissance were not church-going Christians. Like many artists throughout history, they were concerned human beings who served as society's ritual priests and prophets. Seeking out the meaning of the black experience in a world defined by white supremacy. As witnesses to black suffering, they were, in the words of African-American literary critic Trudier Harris, active tradition bearers of the uglier phases of black history. In the wake of slavery and the Civil War, there is so much ugliness in black life that one would have had to be blind not to see it. And nothing, absolutely nothing, was uglier than lynching in all of its many forms: hanging, burning, beating, dragging, and shooting, as well as torture, mutilation, and especially castration. And yet so many were blind, deaf, and dumb. What enabled artists to see what Christian theologians and ministers would not? What prevented these theologians and ministers, who would have been the first to see God's revelation in black suffering, from recognizing the obvious gospel truth? Both white theologians and black preachers throughout the African American history either did not see the parallels between the cross and the lynching tree, or else they were too fearful of the dire consequences. Loss of social status, work, and possibly life to make the connection. In short, they lacked imagination of the most crucial and moral kind.
Yeah, I really like that last line. They lacked imagination of the most crucial and moral kind. What does that imagination, what is that imagination? It's not like people, it's not like people weren't making art then. It's not like people weren't using their imagination. But what weren't they doing?
They weren't aware of the canary in the coal mine.
Uh-huh.
They were sending out that signal through the arts.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say?
I mean, an artist, a poet or an artist, the first thing that they do is they look at the world around them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they talk about theologians. I mean, I think of theologians being in their minds.
Uh-huh.
Artists look at what is before them, and then they create from that.
And speaking as a theologian, and just as a fellow Christian, I would say we are very good at turning a blind eye to what we don't want to see. Right? And maybe that's sometimes the function of theology itself. We take the cross and we turn it into an atonement theory that explains why it was all a good thing in the end. Right?
Yeah.
And maybe there's something really problematic about that. Yeah.
I just wanted to throw out the word connection, which I think is what artists do.
Mm-hmm.
Connect things that maybe aren't connected in people's minds, but that they have the imagination to see that connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's a call for contemplation, because if we don't sit still enough and think about what's happening, is this really okay? Is this really, or are we just kind of floating along with the tide of the popular culture? And I think that's
right.
What he asks us to do with considering Matthew Schiff.
Good, yeah. I totally agree with you about it being a call for contemplation, but I also just want to emphasize it's a contemplation of a very particular kind, because typically we contemplate beautiful things.
Right.
Typically we contemplate good things.
And
yeah, please.
When you, my experience of growing up Lutheran, not anymore, but growing up Lutheran, was that the cross was a beautiful thing. So this was in the 50s. That's how it was taught to me.
Right.
And, you know, so it was the cross is empty because Jesus rose from the dead. And so I had a hard time relating to it until I really realized and was presented with what the cross really was.
Right. Last comment, and then I want to close with a song from Considering Matthew Shepard.
Well, it just seems to me that artists historically have been the visionaries. The artists have seen typically through literature or through visual art, through music.
Mm-hmm.
They see society, they see the world in a different way, and it's probably that the imagination works differently. So they have been the visionaries who have told us in advance sometimes of what the really crucial issues are.
And another word for visionary there might be prophets, right? That their prophets speak the truth that mainstream Christians, mainstream religious people aren't ready for yet, right? And artists can serve that function.
I've never seen pictures or artwork like that in my 67 years. Because it's not being presented to the wider population. It's not being shown. It's being suppressed, maybe.
Right. So it's probably a reminder that just because one is an artist doesn't mean one's contemplating these sorts of things, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can do a kind of snow globe version of the Christian story that we could call art, but it's not this prophetic sort of art.
Well, look what the stand-up comedians are doing.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen to them sing in the coal mine.
Yeah, but they're being prophetic themselves.
Hearing what they're saying.
Good.
In Chaim Potok's book, My Name is Asher Lev,
mm-hmm.
about the young artist who pursues art in opposition to his parents, his one thing that he has to do he thinks, is to paint the crucifixion. He cannot be an artist until he paints the crucifixion. So he sneaks off to the art galleries to look at images of the crucifixion, paints his own, mm-hmm. which is kind of the final separation between himself and his parents. But he has to do that as an artist.
I'd like to get the name of that from you again after class, because I'm not familiar with that book, but I would love to read that.
I know we're listening to the music, yeah. And I want to give time for that, but I think it's important to lift up, as a black artist in the room and the only black person in the room, I have to lift up like my experiences and the discomfort that I feel when I'm like the only black person in the room, we have white bodies gazing at lynchings, and I just want to emphasize the importance of a contemplative action as well, because this isn't something that's only historical, as you've already made those connections, right? This is still happening today.
Yeah.
And when I see black bodies all over the internet, when I go back home to North Minneapolis, friends and family who are still being brutalized and still being lynched in the streets, and there's not that empathy or compassion that leads to movement, to breaking those cycles, to causing transformation. Like, I'm carrying with me, I see this, I lifted up this active tradition bearers of these artists. Mm-hmm. I feel compelled to carry forward that tradition in honor of my family and my ancestors and my community to speak to those injustices and have a call for contemplative action, to not just think about it and not just gaze at it, but to actually be stirred enough to try to make a real change, because this is my reality that I'm experiencing as well. So yeah, I just want to lift that up.
Thank you for saying that. And I think this is another way in which the sort of contemplation we're talking about here is different from the sort of artistic contemplation we often talk about. Because in the same when we gaze upon the beautiful, right, it doesn't really solicit any sort of response. Or it solicits maybe an aesthetic response, but not an action, right? And my hope would be that when we look at those pictures of black bodies, when we look at pictures of the black bodies that are still being killed in our streets today, that if we really open our eyes to them, that it calls forth an ethical response, right? And it makes us become activists and not just spectators. It's one interesting thing about the spectacle of the crosses. I mean, when we say as a Roman spectacle, it was meant to produce a certain response, which is quietism. But what does it mean when Christians transform that in a way that solicits an ethical engagement with the world right now?
And I just have to say, I'm so glad that you showed the photo of St. Paul, because we have a pastor at our church who just came from California, and she was talking during a sermon about the museum, the new lynching museum, and looking at some of these same photos in our church, and except she talked about the South and lynchings happening only in the South. And if we don't own that, it's not a Southern thing. It's not a non-Christian thing.
Right.
It's us.
Yeah, and I think that when we talk about the sort of the whiteness of the ELCA, for example, I think way more important than just creating diversity for its own sake is actually engaging on behalf of racial justice in our world right now. I think that's more important than just sort of a tokenistic, we need more people of color in our churches. I think if we start by saying we need to stand up for people of color, we need to make racial justice in our society a core priority of our church, I think that's the place we should start. Right? So I think rather than playing this song, I think this is a good place to end it. You can certainly listen to it.
Could you play for those who want to stay?
Okay. This song has the voice of God in it. I assume it's the voice of God. I won't say anything more than that. Is Sharon here?
You're fine.
Are we okay?
I don't dare say anything else.
Okay, so it's interesting. I would say this is, just by virtue of having God speak in this song, it's the most theological of all of the pieces. It's interesting to relate this to the questions of activism and concrete ethical engagement that Joe is pointing us towards as we listen to this. But it's yeah, it's very much connected to this metaphor of seeing. Hang on, sorry.